Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Bee Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicbee.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Today, Dow AgroSciences, LLC, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Dow Chemical Company, announced that U.S. regulatory authorities have approved the new insecticidal active ingredient, sulfoxaflor, to be marketed in the U.S. as Transform and Closer. The U.S. registration and the recent Canadian registration are the result of a global joint review, which also includes Australia. Australian sulfoxaflor registration is expected by third quarter of 2013. South Korea, Panama, Vietnam, Indonesia, and Guatemala have already registered sulfoxaflor, and additional global registrations are expected in the near future. Sulfoxaflor belongs to a novel chemical class called sulfoxamines, which is invented by Dow AgroSciences and offers extremely effective control of many important sap-feeding insect pests. It can be used in a large number of major crops, including cotton, soybean, citrus, palm, and stone fruit, nuts, grapes, potatoes, vegetables, and strawberries. In this special encore segment of the Neonicotinoid View, you can listen to the interview that explains what the environmental impact is by Dr. Susan Kegley, principal and founder of the Pesticide Research Institute. Please visit TheOrganicView.com for more information about sulfoxaflor, as well as additional videos that will follow. If you are not receiving our most recent interviews, please resubscribe to our new official RSS feed, which can be found on iTunes, YouTube, or you can visit our podcast archives, which can be found at www.TheOrganicView.com. Thank you, and here's the show. As we continue our special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my co-host Tom Theobald and I will be joined today by Dr. Susan E. Kegley to discuss the impact of sulfoxaflor and discuss the pros and cons of this agrochemical. So I would first like to welcome to the show my co-host Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, June.
And our guest today, Dr. Susan Kegley. Good afternoon, Dr. Kegley.
Hi, June. Hi, Tom. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Dr. Kegley, could you please share with our audience a little bit about yourself and also the work that you do?
I'm a PhD organic chemist, and I have a small business called Pesticide Research Institute, and we do consulting work for governments, for nonprofits, for commercial beekeepers, a wide variety of clients, and we look at pesticides as they travel through the environment, and we know a lot about the fate of a chemical in the environment. We do environmental monitoring. We do air sampling, in particular water sampling, to see how these pesticides are distributed once they're released into the field. We also do a lot of work on the toxicology, human toxicology, and ecological toxicology of pesticides. So we have a lot of databases that provide us with information. We're continuing to develop our databases so that we have lots of information. And one of our main goals is that people doing pest management can make informed decisions. We develop tools for farmers, for consumers, in terms of managing pests with low-impact methods, as low-impact as possible.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Kegley, this is Tom, obviously, I guess. we've focused in the past several months, actually for the past couple of years, on one of the systemic pesticides, the neonicotinoid clothianidin. Now, what we're going to talk about today is an additional systemic pesticide. The name is sulfoxaflor. Can you explain briefly just how sulfoxaflor relates to clothianidin?
Well, sulfoxaflor and clothianidin, and in fact all of the neonicotinoids, work on the nicotinyl acetylcholinesterase site, and they bind to the same site, which affects the way the nerve impulses are transmitted in the insects. And the Dow, the manufacturer of sulfoxaflor, indicates that this new pesticide is not the same as the neonicotinoids and that it acts in a different mechanism. The reason that's important is that people who are trying to control pests now have a resistance problem. The insects are resistant to the neonicotinoids. It's starting anyway. And Dow is interested in getting what they call a new chemistry out there, which works in a different way. But in fact, there's real controversy about whether sulfoxaflor is acting differently than the neonicotinoids. And in fact, you know, EPA's own assessment groups it as a subclass of neonicotinoids. So what that means is that they've put yet another neonicotinoid pesticide out there, or trying to anyway, trying to get it registered, which means that we have yet another pesticide that is systemic. It's water-soluble enough to be taken up by the plant and expressed in the pollen and the nectar, all of the plant fluids and the plant tissue. So it's no different than clothianidin or imidacloprid in that regard. And that means that exposure potential for pollinators in particular is very high.
Is it being advocated because the earlier systemics are failing, or do they just simply want to add to the mix?
If you read the comment letters that came in on the EPA's proposed conditional registration, there are a whole collection of letters from the researchers that are in the state universities across the South that work on cotton. Also a few from those who grow leafy greens and squash and melons and those kinds of things. And, you know, they are they're very interesting. They all say, oh, we are out of tools. We're losing our tools because of resistance. And what that says is that our whole agricultural system is based on a house of cards where unless you're continually developing new chemistries, your pest control is going to fail. If you look at the way organic farmers do it, they cultivate the natural enemies of the pests. And for cotton, it's the tarnished plant bug that they're worried about. For leafy greens, it's aphids. But organic farmers manage these pests by cultivating habitat for natural enemies, using, if absolutely necessary, using something like a soap or an oil to smother the insects. There are other ways of controlling these pests, but not if you're growing, you know, 1,000 acres all in the same spot. And so our farmers, the farmers have been, they grew up with the chemical method of farming, and now our farmers don't really have the tools to do anything differently, because that's the way they've learned, and it's very risky now to make changes. So I think that we need to change the direction of our farming system, which is not easy. And I, you know, the farmers will say that, and I'm a small farmer. I have a small garden, but I know how difficult it is when you're trying to make some changes. So instead of introducing more and more of these pesticides that the insects will just become resistant to, we need to support farmers in their transition away from depending on these chemicals.
Thank you.
Yes.
There are a lot of similarities with sulfoxaflor and neonicotinoids. Now, this question is for Tom. Tom, can you please share with our audience what the registration history of clothianidin has been?
Well, it's very interesting, and it points up a very serious problem that we're all concerned about. I became interested in clothianidin several years ago because I was having excessive losses, and I traced it to corn, and I believe that the active agent was clothianidin, which was stored in the corn pollen, had a delayed effect on my colonies. But I began exploring the history of clothianidin, and what I found was that it was put on the market basically over the objection of EPA scientists under what's called a conditional registration, in that it's released to the market with questions unanswered, and in many cases those are not too serious questions. But in the case of clothianidin, it was very serious because there was concern that it would have an adverse effect on the pollinating insects, primarily the honeybees. And the condition of registration was a life cycle study that was to have been completed in the first growing season, but wasn't completed for several years. And I wrote an article in the summer of 2010 calling attention to the study that I had uncovered, which had finally been filed and reviewed by the EPA, and it really was scientifically unsound. And EPA scientists went back and reviewed it and concluded the same. At first they concluded it was invalid and then backed off a little bit and called it supplemental, but that's effectively the same. The interesting thing is that what precipitated this was the request in 2010 by Bayer for the use of clothianidin on cotton and mustard. So now, after just two growing seasons, apparently we have pests that are resistant to clothianidin, and a new product, another systemic pesticide, is being advocated, and the EPA proposes once again to release it to the market under a conditional registration with very serious questions unanswered. But the point is, among other things, clothianidin appears to have failed after just two growing seasons. Now we have another, and how long will it be before sulfoxaflor fails, and what will we have coming next? And maybe Dr. Kegley can reflect on that a little bit.
Well, it does take quite a bit of investment for a chemical manufacturer to bring a new pesticide to the market, so I don't really know what they have in their bag of tricks. But they're most certainly working on some of these chemistries and working on getting new pesticides out there. But this whole process of conditional registration, in the absence of enough data to know that you can that this chemical can be released and not cause major damage to the ecosystem or to human health, that's not working anymore. And it never did. And what this does, this process of conditional registration, is that it uses both the humans and the ecosystems, and in this case the bees, as guinea pigs for their field experiments. And they're not turning out so well for the pollinators.
Dr. Kegley, how frequently is the conditional registration process used? And do you feel that this is appropriate?
I don't feel that it's appropriate. We need to get the data that shows that the pesticide can be used without major damage before the chemical is registered. It was quite common in the past. It's still more common than we would like to see, but EPA is certainly paying more attention to it in the last two to 5 years. If you look in the product database, there's some... the last time I checked, it was about 70% of the pesticides had or products, not active ingredients, but products, of which there are maybe 20,000. There were probably 70% that were conditionally registered. So some of these conditional registrations are because they've just taken an existing insecticide and extended the use onto a new crop. Those are probably less problematic than these ones where you have a brand new chemical that's never been used before, and all of a sudden you're releasing it to the environment. So it's something that many of the NGOs have pointed out as a real problem at EPA, and NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, is pursuing this as an issue with EPA.
Thank you. Now, although sulfoxaflor is not a neonicotinoid, it still does target the same synapses. Is there any reason to believe that the consequences won't be the same as they have been for the neonicotinoids?
Well, all of the data that they do have suggests they're going to be very much like the neonics. They're highly acutely toxic to bees. In other words, it doesn't take very much to really kill a bee in a lab test. When an observation like that comes out, the main line of the chemical companies is, oh, well, you know, field exposure is very different, which is true, but not that different. They're still eating the nectar and pollen that comes from treated plants. And so there's not a whole lot of difference between nectar that has sulfoxaflor dissolved in it and sugar water that you've made up in the lab that has sulfoxaflor dissolved in it. So there are certainly issues of whether the bees will actually collect nectar from those flowers, but the way the monoculture of cropping systems is laid out, you put, you know, for, at least for commercial pollination, you have the bees right next to the field they're supposed to be pollinating. They're probably not going to go a lot further away if there's a lot of food there, a lot of flowers. And they probably don't have a good gas chromatograph with a mass spectrometer to decide whether or not there's chemicals in the nectar. These can be real problems for the bees, and I don't see that the lab studies are that different from the field studies or from the field exposures.
Thank you.
Dr. Kegley, you suggested earlier that we need to change the farming practices, and obviously given the direction that it's gone, that's going to be very difficult. I read a study just recently that evaluated the yield of the more conventional crops compared to the genetically engineered and systemically treated crops, and found that the conventional crops actually were more successful. And I think I read that the improvement in the cotton production that's expected with sulfoxaflor, and granted that's just one of the commodity crops, but the improvement in the crop is only going to be like 2%. Can you talk a little bit about the finances of this whole dilemma that we face?
Well, the people who are pushing the pesticide, remember, are going to make money off of the sale of the pesticide. And that's their, I mean, that's the job of the CEO at the chemical company, is to make money for the chemical company. So they don't particularly care about the details as long as it keeps bringing money into their operation. So what we have to think about, I think, is that it's not just the value of cotton, at least if we take a step back and look at it from the 30,000-foot view. It's our whole agricultural system. And if you are killing off all of the pollinators, then you're not going to have a viable agricultural system for too long. And the value of at least pollinated crops, crops that need to be pollinated by pollinators, has been estimated at like $15 to $19 billion in the U.S. alone. This economic analysis needs to account for the fact that we are possibly undermining our entire food system. And so a 2% increase in cotton yields that might last for 5 years or 10 years until the bugs become resistant to that pesticide is probably not a good investment.
Yeah, I have to say, if I were a cotton farmer, I'd be a little miffed, to put it mildly, because it appears that I've been drawn into an agricultural system that's designed to fail, and when it does fail, here's the chemical salesman on my doorstep with a remedy that is going to cost me even more. And little by little, my cash flow goes not to me but to the chemical companies. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I think that's very clearly the way things are going. I'm not sure the farmers see it that way because they've grown up doing chemically based farming, and you know, for many years, you know, the Green Revolution, that was kind of the modern way to farm. We've learned since then that you know, there are some issues with chemical farming. And the problem is that there's a lot of farmers out there that have been doing this for years. And to change what you're doing in farming is risky. Farming is not a high-margin business to start with. But this is where our government can step in and support efforts for research efforts. Instead of having Dow fund all the research at the agricultural schools, we need to get some serious government funding in there so that researchers who want to look into IPM that doesn't require chemicals or is very low chemically intense can get their research funded, because right now that's not possible. And that's why, I mean, looking in the docket for all of the comment letters that came in to the EPA on sulfoxaflor, there's letter after letter after letter, one from Tennessee, Louisiana, Arizona, cotton, Arizona melons, Mississippi, Arkansas. All of these ag schools submitted letters saying, oh, I've tried sulfoxaflor, it's great, it's very soft on arthropods, and it's like, how do, really? You know, do they have enough information to make that conjecture? And I don't think they do. I mean, they are looking at perhaps populations of predator insects, the beneficial insects, but those insects eat insects, not pollen, not nectar. And so it's very different than a pollinator. But, you know, all of these people submitted a letter, and those letters look suspiciously similar, which suggests that perhaps they were given a template letter by the manufacturer, and suggest with the suggestion that they submit a letter to the docket. What this shows us is that our academic research centers are compromised by their collaborations with industry.
Dr. Tegley, is sulfoxaflor being used in any other parts of the world?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know.
I'd be curious.
I know that it's been proposed. Whether it's actually been put into use or not, New Zealand comes to mind.
That's right, yeah.
And that elicited a very strong letter from the New Zealand Beekeepers Association, because they were very concerned about the consequences of its introduction. But it's been proposed. I don't know if it's actually in use.
It was proposed in 2011. That letter was submitted in 2011 by the beekeepers. So I don't know either.
Just out of curiosity, in regards to the cotton farmers that are dealing with some severe issues with pests, what options do they have?
I'm not an expert in cotton farming, so I can't really address that. I do know that if you're growing cotton is typically grown in huge blocks, monoculture blocks, which makes it very difficult to control pests because there's so much food for the pests. It can travel for as far as its small range is and always have food to eat. Intercropping, I know organic cotton, it's a tough crop to grow organically, but people do it, and Patagonia has been very useful in terms of developing that market for organic cotton, but it has to do with cultivating your beneficial insects, making sure that you don't leave a situation like, for example, when you grow cotton next to alfalfa, the Liguus bugs prefer the alfalfa, but if you go in there and cut all the alfalfa down, you see that you have an immediate infestation of Liguus into your cotton because they don't have anywhere else to go. So trap crops are important, and growing smaller plots.
So it sounds like a balanced ecosystem is really the smartest route to go, no matter how you put it.
And right, except that, you know, in our world of increasing, we have to be more efficient. That's harder, right, because you have it's harder to get the equipment in, and you would have to redesign some things. And that's where you need investment right now, is in changing our farming system so it doesn't, so it's still efficient, but doesn't require planting so much of one crop all in the same location.
Sulfoxaflor is being proposed for a wide range of commodity crops and minor crops in addition to cotton. we've talked a little bit about some of the unanswered questions under this conditional registration. Can you just highlight what some of those are?
Well, one of the things that I found in reviewing the data and some of the comment letters in the docket address this is the EPA's economic analysis, which is lacking in a reality check. So, for example, they make the assumption that pollinators will only be in the crop during the early part of the day, and that means that you can spray in the afternoon. Therefore, you know, there's not a problem. Well, what this assumes then is that, A, there are no bees in there in the afternoon, which is not true, and several letters from beekeepers note that, you know, the bees, depends on where you are. The bees do come back to these crops in the afternoon once it cools down. That's right when they've proposed that the spraying be done. And then the bigger problem is that the pesticides don't go away after they are sprayed. In fact, they're taken up by the plant through the plant tissue, and they find it in the pollen and nectar for several weeks afterwards. And so just changing your spray pattern to only apply in the afternoon is not going to solve the problem. Probably the biggest mistake that EPA made on the economic analysis front was assuming that the bees that pollinated the melons and the squash were only used for melons and squash. And the real truth of it is that those same bees are critical for the pollination of our almond crop, blueberries, cherries, apples, pears, all over the country. Beekeeping, commercial beekeeping, is a migratory operation, and these bees do a lot of work all around the country. So if you kill those bees off in the squash and melons from sulfoxaflor, they won't be available for the almond pollination. And in fact, we're observing real problems with availability of bees right now. Now is the almond pollination, kind of peak almond pollination time, and there aren't enough bees to do it. So,
yes. Am I correct in my understanding? I've lost my train of thought. It's escaped me. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. It'll come back to me. The economic analysis. It's my understanding that there's been little consideration given to the environmental costs of sulfoxaflor in particular and many other pesticides in general. Is that correct?
Well, it's hard to, you know, yes, that's correct. And it kind of calls into question our ability to assess the value of an ecosystem, a functioning, fully functional ecosystem to society. And, you know, those values are typically downgraded because you don't have dollar amounts of things that you can sell tied to them. But we can certainly say here that if you don't have pollinators, we will not have strawberries, apples, pears, squash, melons, almonds. We won't have a lot of the food that we currently enjoy. And so it's in our best interest to work out a system that doesn't kill off the pollinators that are responsible for this abundant supply of food.
Well, it seems that the environmental costs are enormous, and I wonder how the EPA could overlook that. And beyond the pollinators, it appears that there's damage being done to things like the bats, soil life, bird life. In Holland, they believe that there have been very precipitous declines in bird life as a consequence of these systemic pesticides. Why does the EPA overlook this significant part of the equation? Maybe you can't answer that, but
can't really answer
maybe
that.
You can.
No, it's hard to do that economic analysis. You know, what value would you assign, what monetary value would you assign to a fully populated, fully functional ecosystem? We don't have many of those left. We almost don't have any data to make that assessment because we've, you know, there's so many places that have been disturbed by human habitation and human interference that we don't know what that's like anymore. But we know that it can't be good, and we can certainly see the effects of, for example, dams or, you know, taking away marshes, and you see the flooding that happens when you don't have the buffering that's provided by the marshes. And you can start to assign values to that. And you can certainly assign values to pollinators because it does play into the food supply. But the worms and the soil bacteria and those kinds of things are much harder to assess value on.
Dr. Kegley, thank you so much for coming on the show today and for sharing with our audience the information that you've been not only researching, but all the things that you've been working on. It's really been a pleasure having you on today.
It's been
a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you both.
And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a wonderful afternoon, everyone.